see in this chapter is that the people of God in Ezra and Nehemiah's time are making a pledge to God. If you were to sum up the chapter, that is what you'll say that they are doing. They're making a pledge to God. They're pledging to be faithful in a number of important areas of their life. I wonder if you noticed that as we read through the chapter. And of course, this pledge hasn't come out of nowhere. As I said before, we read that the people of God had come together and prayed and confessed their sins. And now, on the back of that, they are following through on that prayer. They are making this public pledge to God to follow through on what they have prayed. And I want us to meditate on the pledge that they made, because I want to say this, it is so relevant to us in the 21st century. The three main things that come out from this pledge could not be more relevant to us today. And so I want to consider, first of all, what they pledged. And then secondly, and much more briefly, who made the pledge. So first of all, what they pledged. What was it that the people of God back then actually pledged? Well, if you were to sum it up, essentially, they pledged to keep the law of God. If you look at verse 29 of that chapter, what is it they say? These joined with their brethren and their nobles and entered into a curse and an oath to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and do all the commandments of the Lord our God. That is what they pledged to do. There are other more specific things that they pledged to do, and we'll come to those in a moment. But if you were to sum up what is it that they pledged to do, it was to obey, observe, do the law of God. In fact, there's a little turn of phrase, if you want to put it that way, in verse 28, where it says that they separated themselves to the law of God. Such was their intent to please God, certainly at that time in history. They set themselves over, they separated themselves to the law of God. And what they were doing is they were dedicating themselves to the law of God. They were saying that we will pledge to keep the law of God. And this is not so relevant for us in the 21st century. This should be our pledge too. We should be seeking to keep and do and observe the law of God. We should be separating ourselves to Him and His law. Whatever form His law comes in, whatever it demands it makes of us, we should be pledging, along with these people of old, to observe and do the law of God. This is what the people of God did back then. They recognized that the law of God made certain requirements of them. It made certain demands of them. It wasn't an optional thing that they could check in and out of. They recognized that the law of God impacted every area of their life. In fact, there was no part of their life in which the law of God was off limits. And they recognized that at least three specific areas of their life would perhaps particularly be affected. The first important area was marriage. You see that in verse 30. They recognized that if they were to observe and do the commandments of God, then they needed to only marry in the way that God permitted. That was the first important area of their life that they pledged to be faithful in. The second important area of the life that they pledged to be faithful in was what they did on their Sundays or their Sabbaths. You see that in verse 31. They recognized that if they were to observe and do the commandments of God, then they needed to keep the Sabbath day holy. That was their second pledge. And their third pledge was also an important area. It was the area of giving their money and their produce to the work of the Lord. And in fact, if you look at the chapter, almost the entire chapter is given over to that. They pledged to be those who ensured that the house of God was maintained and not neglected, as it says at the end of verse 39. We will not neglect the house of our God. So these are the three specific pledges that stemmed or came out of the law of God and their desire to observe and do it. And I want to look at those three very briefly this evening. First, this area of marriage. They pledged to be faithful to God in the area of marriage. We read in verse 30 that the people of God pledged that they would not give their daughters and their sons to those around them. We would not give our daughters as wives to the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. They are pledging to be faithful to God in this very important area of marriage. And the reason why they did that is not because they thought it was a good idea, although it is, but because God had commanded this. He had commanded his people to marry only those from within the covenant community. If you look at Exodus chapter 34 and Deuteronomy chapter 7, you will see that God explicitly says that in his word. And of course, there are a number of reasons for that. God doesn't have to give us a reason when he commands us to do something. It is his prerogative. But he often gives us a reason why we should obey him. And the reason why is because if they married unbelievers, then their hearts would be turned away from him. If they married people from other religions or no religion at all, it is extremely likely, we're talking 99% of the time, that their hearts would also be caused to follow after the false god or no god at all. Now you might think that's a very easy and obvious thing to avoid, but the people of God back then had not long succumbed to this very thing. If you look at Ezra chapter 9, if you remember as you're going through that book, that's unbelievably the people of God back then married unbelievers. They did take wives and husbands from those around us, from around them. And how important this is for each one of us to know, especially any amongst us who desire to marry. I spoke about this issue at length last year. I think I preached three times on it as we thought about the creation ordinances. But I'm not embarrassed to mention it again because we need to hear this time and time again. Because Christians seem to waver on this issue. Christians even are tempted to ignore this issue. But the Bible is so clear on this that we must not avoid it. The Bible could not be clearer. Christians are to marry only in the Lord, as it says in 1 Corinthians 7. Why? Because if you marry an unbeliever, it is extremely likely that they will drag you away from the one true and living God. It needs to be said because there are Christians who think that it doesn't apply to them, that they will be stronger and that this spouse that I will marry will not drag me away from the Lord. But they will. By and large, they will. 99% of the time. Now, there is a temptation in many of us to marry. I think it's harder for the older population in the church to understand this. But the pool for Christians who are younger is extremely small. It wasn't back in your day, but it is in our day. And there's a great temptation that if an unbeliever comes along, perhaps you're working with them or rubbing shoulders with them at a social club, whatever it may be, you may be tempted to give in to this. Perhaps for the first time they've shown you a genuine interest. Perhaps it's the first time it's happened. Alongside that, they've got a great personality. Maybe they're rich. Maybe they're good looking. And you begin to entertain the idea that maybe I could convert that person. They're good after all. They're not against what I'm doing. They let me go to church. I'm just saying, don't do it. Don't do it. It'll be one of the biggest mistakes that you make in your life. Recently, I was caused to remember the sirens that appear in Homer's epic, The Odyssey. And the sirens seem so attractive to sailors. And they sing, don't they? And they lure the sailors into shipwreck. And the sailors are destroyed. And if you marry an unbeliever, that's what's going to happen to you. 1% of you may not happen, but that is what will happen overall. And it's, I say it in love. I know what it's like to struggle in a very small group of people, but don't do it. Don't do it. Wait for the Lord. It's better to be single. Let me say this again. It is better to be single than marry an unbeliever. And so this is the first area that they pledged to be faithful in. And I ask you, will you be faithful in that? Will you be faithful in that area? The second important area of their lives that the people of God pledged to be faithful in was the Sabbath day. In verse 31, they promised that if the people of the surrounding nations were to come in with their things to sell on the Sabbath day, on the Sunday, then they would not buy anything from them. That's what they pledged. And they pledged this because they knew what the law of God said. They knew that God required them to keep the Sabbath day holy. Holy means to be set apart, different from the other 6 days when they can do, by and large, whatever you want under God's law. One day is to be set aside, given over to the worship of God. God permits his people to have 6 days, 6 out of 7 days, to do whatever they want within the bounds of his gracious law. He only asks us for one day. 1 in 7. I'm not a mathematician. That's a small percentage. He asks us for one day of worship. And they recognized that, and so they said, the very least we can do is not buy from those nations around us. That is what they pledged. Will you be faithful in this area? So many others don't keep the Sabbath day. Many Christians don't keep the Sabbath day holy. And it means that if you are to be those who are faithful in this area, then at the very least, you should not be going to restaurants which employ people on Sunday, or supermarkets which employ people on Sunday, so that you can buy or do whatever you want on your day. No, we are to be like the people of God back then and to pledge that this is a holy day, that not just Christians have to keep it, but that, in fact, God requires it of the whole nation. Will you be faithful in this area? I hope at some point in the near future to preach on this important topic soon. But will you pledge to be faithful in this area? It doesn't take much to plan ahead and do your shopping on Saturday so that you don't have to go on Sunday. I'm not going to go on about it, but it is a witness to the world. If we have a day set apart. We know the Islamic day, don't we? It's a Friday. It's very obvious it's their day. Is it obvious that Christians have a holy day? I'm not so sure. So will you pledge to be faithful in that area? The third important area of their lives that they pledged to be faithful in was in the area of giving their money and produce to the Lord. And we see that in verse 32 and following. Here, the people of God pledged to give some of their money and some of their produce to ensure that the service of the house of God would be maintained. So we read in verse 32 that the people pledged to exact or give from themselves yearly 1/3 of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. And if we read in verse 35 and following, for instance, we will read that the people pledged to bring the first fruits of their crops and their animals and so on. Now, why did they do that? Well, we have to get back into the time of when this was written. This is the Old Testament, when they worshipped God in a different way. They needed animals. They needed produce to come with their worship to God. Think about the what's called a ceremonial system, where they would come and offer sacrifices, animals, and also crops to God. That was part of their worship back then. You can read about that in the book of Leviticus mainly, but also Exodus and Numbers. And God commanded the people of God to do these things in those days. So, for instance, we read that the people bring animals to God, whether it be the daily burnt offerings that we read about in verse 38, or the animal that was offered once a year on the Day of Atonement. These animals were offered to God in order to please him. That's what he said back then. If you offer these things, they will be a pleasing aroma to me. Now, ultimately, they forced the people of God back then forward to think about the Messiah, the Lord Jesus Christ, who would, in fact, take away the sins of the people. And I think that's what we most of all think when we think about the Old Testament worship, the animals that were brought. But they also brought, you could call it cereals or grain offerings as part of their worship. So these were rural communities, farmers mainly. And as part of their worship, they would bring the first fruits of their crops to God. And in offering the first fruits of their crops, they were doing two things. First of all, they were showing their gratitude to God. And then secondly, and relatedly, they were dedicating themselves to God. So first, in bringing the first fruits of their crops, they were thanking God for what he had given him. He, after all, had given them the crops. Think about all those fields. And they were bringing a small portion of it back to him to say thank you to him for providing for them. That was the first thing that this cereal offering was for. It was to give thanks to God, to show gratitude to him for what he had so abundantly given them. They in return gave a small portion of it back. And secondly, and relatedly, it was an offering symbolizing their dedication or devotion to God. So they were declaring their devotion to him. It is more than interesting that the grain offerings were always presented when the animal was presented too. And there was a reason for that. Because as they offered the animal, which was for the taking away of sin, symbolically, right on the heels of that, they were offering this grain offering to say that we thank you for what you have done in cleansing us from our sins, and as a result, we are now giving you our first fruits. It was a response to the forgiveness of sin. They were saying when they offered their first fruits, that as we have been pardoned totally of all of our sins, so we now offer ourselves totally to God. This is the second part of that first fruits that were offered, devotion to God. And so as these people are making this pledge, this is what they're pledging to do, that they would bring the animals to be sacrificed, but they would also bring the first fruit offering to show their thankfulness to God and also their devotion to him. And as we come to a close, notice how they pledged to do these things continually. It was not a spur-of-the-moment thing that they pledged to do, or a sporadic thing. These offerings had to be made continually. The animals and the crops needed to be brought all the time. And so the people pledged to bring their offerings continually. Now, we must know that the Old Testament worship was a big operation. If you know that, the worship of God required hard sacrificial work. It affected all kinds of life, parts of life. So, for instance, if you think about the altar that had to be used in worship, even the firewood had to be collected in order that that altar were continually burned. And so, interestingly, in verse 34, the people of God ensured by taking lots that the firewood would continue to be collected for the altar fire. Now, why are we telling all this? Because the reason why they did this, down to the very firewood and collecting of it, think about the menial work that is. The reason why they did this is because they took the worship of God seriously. It was important to them. Take away the firewood and you have no worship. Take away the other elements, the sacrifices, you have no worship, or at least it's hindered. And so the people of God pledged to do these things because the worship of God was so important to them. Remember, we're at this, as it were, high point of Nehemiah where they are pledging to do things and they're serious about it. And this speaks to us, doesn't it? We have to ask ourselves the question, what are we willing to do to ensure that the worship of God is maintained? How far are we willing to go as a congregation to ensure that the worship of God is maintained? To say along with the people back then in verse 39 that we will not neglect the house of our God. Now there are obvious things like the ministry costs or the buying of things like bread and wine. These are obvious to us. They're necessary for the worship of God. Without these things, we can't celebrate the Lord's Supper. We can't have the words preached. But perhaps there are other things less obvious to us that maintain the worship of God in this place. Things that we take for granted. Things like the electricity that runs during this meeting. The heating, the water. These are the firewood of our day. The bills that need to be paid in order to facilitate worship. The various taxes that we pay in our country that seem to go up every year. The cleaning costs, whatever it is. Whatever it is that facilitates the worship of God, these things have to be paid for. And they have to be paid for by the congregation. Because it may not surprise you that the government does not give us anything towards those bills. We can have a conversation about gift aid, but really it's just a little bit of relief that they're giving us on things that are ours anyway. We are not living in those days when the Persian kings were subsidizing these things, if you remember that in Ezra chapter 6 and 7. And so the service or the maintenance of the worship of God falls upon the congregation. It's always been that way. That's one of the reasons why we take up an offering every week, or why people give to the church through online giving. Why? It is so the service of the house of God is maintained and all that goes along with that. Now, this of course comes at a cost, of course, whether that's literally or in other ways. So if you pledge to keep the holy day, the Sabbath day holy, for instance, you will have to give up your Sunday when others around you are doing whatever they want on it. If you pledge to marry only in the Lord, then you will be drastically narrowing your options for marriage. You won't be able to marry anyone like the world can. If you pledge to give to the church through tithes and offerings, then you will have less money to spend on yourself. Others can spend their money on whatever they like, but you won't be able to. You see, there's a cost, whether literal or otherwise. But this is what God calls us to be faithful in all three of those areas and much more. But I want to tell you this, that this is the better path to take. It is always better to obey God, even if it doesn't make sense to us. It doesn't make sense to the world. There's always a cost to following the Lord Jesus. But in the end, it's not much of a cost to pay. And it doesn't matter what the world thinks. God commands us to be faithful in these three areas and other areas, of course. And I want to say this, that it will be to our blessing if we do these things. If you keep the Sabbath day holy, you'll be blessed. If you marry a believer, you'll be blessed. Or choose to be single rather than marry an unbeliever, then you will be blessed. If you give to the church, you will be blessed. So will you pledge to observe and do the law of God in these three areas and in other areas of your life that the law of God affects and demands? You know, we are given the impression that most of the people pledged to do those things back then. Even the leadership took the pledge. Did you notice that Nehemiah himself in verse 1 took this pledge or made this pledge? The priests and the Levites and so on. What an important thing that is when the leadership aren't just telling everyone else what to do and not doing it themselves, or the leadership are against what the other leaders are doing. But not everyone in this community is mentioned, and it may be for practical reasons that not everyone is mentioned. So you can imagine a large group of people having to make this pledge. But I do wonder why everyone is not mentioned. It may be that there were those who did not make the pledge. And I say that because not that long ago in Nehemiah, there were those in that community who did not put their shoulder to the work. Do you remember that? The nobles, for whatever reason, did not put their shoulder to the work. So there they were in the community of God's people, but they didn't lift a finger to help build the walls. And it may be, I can't prove it, but it may be that there were those who did not sign up to this pledge. So I have to ask the question, will you sign up to that pledge on these three areas and others? And will you stick to that pledge? The sad thing about all this is that at least some of the people did not keep their pledge on these very three areas. If you look at later in the book of Nehemiah, you will see that the people failed, at least some of them, to keep the Sabbath. And they did marry people from pagan nations. If you look at chapter 13, if you look at the book of Malachi, which is a contemporary of Ezra and Nehemiah, you will notice that the people brought offerings to God that were not acceptable. Malachi chapter 1. So, it is very possible to be in the community of God, to be in a church building, and either not make the pledge at all, or stand up and make the pledge and not actually follow through. So, where are you? Where are you as an individual? Have you made the pledge? And if you have made the pledge, as it were, are you following through? This chapter speaks to us clearly on keeping the law of God. And it's extremely important. And may we be given the grace to respond in these three areas and more for the glory of God.